Welcome to the HJ Talks About Abuse podcast, the podcast where we talk about sexual abuse cases in the hope that it will assist listeners in openly discussing topics which have been ignored for too long. This podcast is brought to you by the abuse team at Hugh James. We are lawyers, so we tend to speak about the legal aspects of abuse cases, but we aren't too shy to speak up about the broader issues faced by survivors of sexual abuse too. We hope that you find it interesting, but more than that, if you are a survivor of sexual abuse, we hope that you find our discussion empowering.
Hello, podcast listeners. I'm Alan Collins, partner at Hugh James Solicitors, and this is one of our regular podcasts. And I'm very pleased to have back with us Dr. Michael Salter, who is an associate professor at the University of New South Wales. Thank you, Michael, for joining us once again. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And podcast listeners, we are going to be discussing, once again, trauma bonding. So there was a podcast a little while back on trauma bonding. It was quite a subject and we had some interest in it. And so I thought, well, let's have a look at it again and have some input from Michael Salter. So, Michael, you have some interesting takes on trauma bonding. So perhaps if you could give us a little introduction as to where you come from on this.
So trauma bonding is a term that's used to describe, I think, a pretty commonly observed issue, which is the intense emotional attachments that people can feel to perpetrators of abuse and violence. And there's no doubt that particularly when it comes to, for example, child sexual abuse, that we can see victims in childhood and also in adulthood with quite intense and quite conflicted feelings of affection and closeness towards the perpetrator of this abuse. So trauma bonding is sometimes understood as being very similar to Stockholm syndrome, the idea that people, in a sense, fall in love with their captors. And it's worth recognizing that the concept of Stockholm syndrome is quite contested. It refers to a hostage-taking incident in a bank robbery in Stockholm in Sweden in the early 70s. And the psychiatrist, the consultant psychiatrist in that case, experienced some difficulties communicating with the hostages who ultimately refused to testify against the bank robbers. And he argued that essentially the hostages, the women in that case, had fallen in love with their hostage takers. In fact, from the point of view of particularly one woman who'd been taken hostage, she observed that the conduct of the police and the conduct of this psychiatrist in their management of the case actually put the hostages at risk, that they were very worried about the police response and the potential actually for the police response to kill them during the hostage crisis. And when they left, when they were basically freed as hostages, they were very angry with the way that the police and the psychiatrist had handled the case, which they felt was a huge risk to their safety. So Stockholm Syndrome's got this quite contested history. And Jess Hill, in her recent book, See What You Made Me Do, which is a fantastic book just launched in the UK, she provides quite a detailed breakdown of the way that Stockholm Syndrome as a concept can be quite a misogynist explanation for really the complex ways that victims of abuse and violence enter into or feel conflicted about their perpetrators. And it's always important when we're looking at why people feel close to perpetrators of abuse and violence or may appear to be loyal to them or may not leave the perpetrator of abuse and violence. It's really important that we take into account the broader context and often the failure of other institutions to support the victim, to care for the victim, and to provide them with a safe pathway to leave.
Okay, so I've got a couple of thoughts and questions here. So the first one is, well, lots of survivors, victims of child abuse are groomed. So the perpetrator manipulates them psychologically. Psychologically, they get manipulated. So they're sort of groomed so that the child's mindset is sort of rewired in a way to make them even more susceptible to the abuse, if I can put it like that. So how does that fit with the concept of trauma bonding? Because that, in a way, through the grooming, the victim becomes bonded.
Yeah, I'd actually see grooming as quite distinct from trauma bonding. In terms of how we understand trauma bonding, I think we can understand it in terms of the manipulation of attachment needs, particularly for children and for young people. So when we're talking about attachment, we're talking about the fundamental need in childhood, particularly young childhood and teenagers, for attachment. So that's the way in which we seek the attention of the people that we're dependent on. Human beings are vulnerable. We are dependent as mammals on our caregivers for a very extended period of time, for many, many years. When we look at other mammals, they become self-dependent, able to feed themselves, look after themselves quite young. That's not true for human beings. We depend on our caregivers for a very long time. And so survival as a human being is really dependent on the attachment process whereby, as children, we seek the attention of our caregiver and we try to establish a very close bond with our caregiver. Now, what we see in situations of child abuse and neglect is we see that children do become bonded to traumatic caregivers. Because if the child is being abused by their caregiver, then their attachment needs escalate. They have even more needs because they're being abused. And the only person in their vicinity who they can see will attend to those needs is the very same person that is perpetrating abuse against them. And so I think that's where the concept of trauma bonding comes into its own, is helping us to understand those very deep emotional ties that children feel towards abusive caregivers. When we're talking about grooming, this is a very important concept. Normally, when we're thinking about grooming, we're thinking about the ways in which perpetrators, typically outside the family, attempt to emotionally entrap the child in a sexually abusive relationship. I think it has some overlaps with trauma bonding, but grooming tends to involve older children. It tends to involve perpetrators from outside the family who are trying to create in the child a sense that they are in almost a boyfriend-girlfriend type relationship.
Indeed. And moving off on a tangent there, something I want to pick up on with you is that this concept of manipulation, because don't we see this in abusive adult relationships where a partner comes to accept maybe violence in a relationship as normal in order to sustain the relationship and to cope with the relationship psychologically, because they've got this very dependent need maybe on the other partner who is behaving in a very abusive fashion to them. So they sort of come to accept or choose to accept sexual violence or physical violence or whatever it happens to be.
I think it's important to recognize, you know, when it comes to abusive relationships in adulthood, essentially really all of us are vulnerable. You know, I work in the child abuse and domestic violence sector, and, you know, I know domestic violence specialists who were in abusive relationships while they worked in the domestic violence sector, and they knew they were in abusive relationships. It wasn't because they had a dependent personality or they had a particular vulnerability. It's because of the ways in which in abusive relationships, you know, people slowly erode our boundaries. They can slowly undermine our self-esteem. They can slowly challenge what we understand to be real and true. And this process can take place over time in a way that's actually really quite difficult to observe and to oppose until we suddenly realize that we're trapped. This is particularly challenging for women because, particularly around child rearing. And so for women who find themselves, particularly when they have kids with the offender, he may have positioned them in such a way that they're financially dependent on him. They're not able to leave him without really quite significant financial implications for themselves and their kids. And sometimes it's just not financially possible. So yes, the emotional grooming aspect is really important for us to bear in mind. But always we need to attend to the broader context in which people are making their choices. And what we find is that when we pay attention to the context of these abusive relationships, we often find that people, yes, have made compromises to stay in an abusive relationship, but they were given very few realistic options to leave and to live independently of the perpetrator.
What about the situation where it goes even further than that, where the violence, the physical violence or the sexual violence in a relationship is considered, well, that's just normal. This is what happens in this part of our community, so to speak, so that it's not just a situation of emotionally coping and adjusting with the violence. It's actually a real acceptance that this is normal. In which case, it begs the question, well, if you're sort of accepting the violence in a relationship as being normal, this is just what happens, doesn't that sort of blur the distinction between victim and perpetrator?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. And certainly when we look at the spectrum of abusive relationships, you know, we do see relationships, for example, where there's violence from both partners against each other. It then becomes really difficult to make that distinction between perpetrator and victim. There is also scenarios, as you say, where physical and sexual violence in the relationship becomes quite normalized. There's been some quite striking testimony circulating on social media recently from the US actress Rachel Evans Woods. And I'd really encourage your listeners to go and watch this video of Rachel Evans Woods testifying about a relationship that she entered into when she was 18. The offender in this case is quite a well-known celebrity. She doesn't name him, but it's clear who she's talking about. And she describes exactly what you're recounting. She's describing a relationship where there was a lot of violence, a lot of coercion, a lot of isolation, that at the time of the relationship, she understood it to be normal. She understood it to be healthy. It's only been in retrospect now that she's able to name it for what it is. And what she describes is very, very serious, you know, very, very serious. But at the time, she thought it was consensual. And so there are certainly relationships where it's only in retrospect that people are able to name what's happening to them. And the violence and abuse can be shrouded in all sorts of ways. It can be shrouded, for example, as consensual, I think in Rachel Evans Wood's case, consensual BDSM. So consensual sorts of sexual practices that she argues now she couldn't possibly have consented to. She was too young and there was a lot of manipulation in that relationship to normalize what was going on. In some of my research with gay bisexual men, where there's physical and sexual violence in relationships, sometimes that's been normalized between men as, well, that's just normal between men. Men are aggressive and that's just something that we put up with in our relationships. So there's other kinds of rationalizations that we can see for physical and sexual violence. And it can take people a while to name it for what it really is, which is illegal conduct.
Yeah, well, thank you for that, Michael, because it just demonstrates to me how these concepts such as trauma bonding and grooming can be extremely subtle, and it requires considerable insight into understanding what has been taking place, what has been taking place inside that relationship. So from what I've learned from looking into trauma bonding and discussing it with you, is increasing my understanding into how subtle manipulation can be, how subtle grooming can be, and it requires a lot of understanding and patience in understanding how someone can be in a relationship where they have, for want of a better term, tolerated or sort of benignly accepted the violence, so to speak. So any concluding thought for you, Mike?
Yeah, I think trauma bonding is a useful term, but I would encourage us to use it sparingly. I don't want people to feel as though their connection, their conflicted feelings towards a perpetrator in some way traumatically encoded or deeply embedded in a way that, you know, that they are unable to address or work through. You know, all of these feelings, conflicted feelings, loyal feelings towards a perpetrator is very, very normal sorts of feelings to have in the context of abuse and violence. I think we do see trauma bonding, particularly for quite young children who have been subject to abuse and violence. And then this certainly continues well into adulthood. And I work with people quite regularly who really struggle to extricate themselves from very abusive families of origin where there's been a lot of abuse since early childhood. But you've introduced important terms, you know, like grooming. And we can certainly think about a lot of abusive relationships in that sense. And always just paying attention to that broader question, you know, what are the opportunities to leave? And what we find is that for people trapped in abusive relationships, very often they haven't, external agency services haven't given them a safe pathway to get out of the relationship. So, you know, yes, we can think about what's going on in the victim psychology, but always with that eye to our responsibilities to victims and survivors to help them live a life that's safe and free.
Very good point, because I always say that it is society's responsibility to address all of these issues, and it's not down to a particular individual or individuals. So thank you very much, Michael. Thank you very much, podcast listeners. Much appreciated. Please do join us on our next podcast. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of HJ Talks About Abuse. You can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or your favourite podcast player. If you'd like to speak to us about something you've heard today, we'd love to hear from you. Email us at aboutabuse@hjtalks.co.uk.